Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. Apologize for a bit of a lingering cold that I've had for a while. Not a serious one, but one that's been hanging around and putting a little, quite a bit of mucus into the throat. So I hope it's not too disturbing. I'll probably be clearing my throat fairly frequently this evening. A theme that was coming to mind today to talk about. We talked a little bit also in the tea time questions and answers today. The teachings around the quality of virya energy that the Buddha describes as one of the necessary qualities that we have to engage with and develop in practice. It's mentioned in a number of different places in the teachings, and it's one of the factors of indriyas. One of the five indriyas, virya, the five indriyas being saddha, faith, virya, energy, sati, mindfulness, samadhi, concentration, and panya, wisdom. So it's the second in that grouping of the indriyas, the five spiritual faculties. And as they're fully developed into the five powers, it's also a factor there. It's a factor in the basis of success in anything we do. Chanda, virya, citta, vimamsa, virya being the second one there again. It's in the Bhojanga, the seven factors of awakening, the second one, or third one, I guess, sati first, and dhammavicaya second, and virya after that. So it's it plays a prominent factor in the teachings in a number of different places, and is often tied with right effort, sammavayama, the four right efforts. Of being the effort to abandon unwholesome qualities that have arisen, the effort to prevent unwholesome qualities that haven't arisen yet, the effort to develop wholesome qualities that haven't yet arisen, and the effort to maintain wholesome qualities that have arisen. So virya and vayama are closely associated with each other, virya sort of being the underlying energy, the underlying momentum used to support the right effort, as I just mentioned. So it's the energetic component of what we have to do to steer our practice, steer our minds, steer our actions and thoughts in directions that are supportive of developing the path and avoiding those that are unwholesome, unsupportive in developing the path. So this practice takes energy. And there's certain energetic qualities that I think are useful to look at in our minds as we examine our actions and our speech and our intentions. And some of the qualities that are unwholesome have a certain energetic pattern to them that can also be seen in wholesome qualities. There are some energy patterns that are very similar to each other, but result in wholesome or unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind, depending on kind of what the underlying state is that's influencing them. So you can have a very clear mind with sati sampajanya, a sense of knowing and circumspection around the where we're putting our attention, and that there's a certain energy that can arise from that that results in really skillful kinds of mind states. And if the mind is clouded and deluded and under the influence of the defilements, under the influence of Mara, then a similar energy pattern can result in unskillful actions, body, speech, and mind, and create some karmic consequences that we'd rather not have to engage in. It could cause difficulty or harm or suffering. Yet the energy patterns have some similar things. So it's real important to kind of examine the underlying quality of energy behind any action and try to determine whether it's something that can, if it's unwholesome, can it be turned around in some way or a similar energy be used towards skillful ends. We were up in White Salmon this past week at the Paba for Pacific Hermitage, and I was asked to give a short reflection, and a memory came up into my mind that is kind of applicable in this particular situation of a time when a number of years ago, actually in the early years of the monastery, we were going through some community ups and downs, well, some downs actually at that time, just having some difficulty, interpersonal difficulties. We were in the, as I mentioned at the Hermitage, we were sort of, in the community was in the storming phase of our group process of, what's that, I call that forming, storming, norming, and conforming. We were in a storming period. And so wanted to develop some skills around communication. We'd started having group meetings to kind of establish a sense of trust and ironing out some community issues. And we ended up engaging with a facilitator who came up for a weekend workshop with us on nonviolent communication, NVC. I'm sure some of you are familiar with that. And throughout the weekend, we did a fair amount of role-playing, certain dialogues, conversations, taking on different stances, if you will, different characters, and consciously choosing whether we were going to be skillful in our interactions, try to be skillful, or try and practice being unskillful, just to sort of get a sense of the feeling of what the difference is and how to be skillful in our speech and our communication versus when it's motivated by unwholesome states of mind through these role plays. And one of the techniques that this facilitator used, I think, is used in MVC, is using these little hand puppets. One of them is a jackal, and one of them is a rabbit, I think, if I remember that right. And the jackal, when you're role-playing the mind of a jackal, you're supposed to be thinking of all the possible unwholesome qualities like anger or greed or jealousy, things like that, that could run through a mind that influence how we speak. And the rabbit representing sort of the more skillful, alert, wholesome kinds of qualities that can be beneath how we speak and communicate with each other. And I was remembering how easy, when we were doing those role plays, how easy it was to role play with the jackal state of mind, how kind of pithy, sarcastic, angry kinds of comments could just roll off the tongue without any trouble at all when that was the role play that we were supposed to do. And how much more effort it took to kind of channel the positive, supportive, constructive, clear kind of speech. And that was clearly something that needed a conscious cultivation. It wasn't nearly so automatic as the other form. And it just demonstrated to me how our conditioning is influencing our behaviors so much of the time, and that conditioning is often, if not most of the time, under the influence of these qualities of greed, hatred, delusion, confusion, desire, aversion. And much less of the time, unless we're really cultivating, much less of the time under the influence of pure and genuine kindness and compassion, mindfulness and skill. And so that these positive mind states certainly take cultivation for most of us. They aren't just automatically there unless we've cultivated them in the past. And to me, this is a lot of what our practice is, as we develop right effort and then the energy, looking at the energy that's manifesting underneath it. Because when we examine the energetic patterns, we have a clue as to the motivations and the mind states that are underlying all of these actions. So one of the most obvious comparisons, I think, of these qualities and how they influence wholesome versus unwholesome energetic patterns is, of course, the quality of tanha, craving, craving, desire, that's always of a unhealthy nature. It's that craving based on wanting to get something that we think is going to be pleasurable, wanting to get rid of something that is unpleasurable, unpleasant, and just the confusion, the delusion of not knowing, but primarily this craving for pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for getting rid of. And how, if that's the basis, our underlying energetic basis, then that kind of wanting to acquire the wish for something will just naturally follow in that course. And And if we follow that all the time, we will experience periodic and momentary experiences of pleasant phenomena. We may be able to escape temporarily some unpleasant kinds of things. But in the long run, they just keep on rebounding, coming back to us. So tanha is one of the forces in our mind that we start to know and observe and work around in terms of how to abandoning, in terms of how to abandon that particular quality, that those kinds of craving. But there's also a form of desire that is a positive energy, one that helps us establish a greater sense of long-term ease, long-term pleasure. Chanda, also translated sometimes as desire, sometimes as like zeal or interest. And it can be used in either an unwholesome or wholesome context, but oftentimes is used in a context denoting a wholesome state of mind, like a desire for Dhamma realization, for Dhamma understanding, a desire for wanting to find a longer-term sense of stability and peace and happiness. So there does have to be that kind of interest in the mind, and it's the same kind of force, that longing for something that creates this sort of momentum in the mind towards a wish for or a longing for something. But when skillfully applied, we'll reach out towards qualities that draw us closer to teachings that will help us realize the path and the ending of suffering, rather than just the temporary gratification of getting what we want in a sensual way or in some other way, or avoiding the unpleasant experiences. Another quality that comes to mind is similarly to tanha, upadana, clinging, and that is energetically the result of craving. If we keep moving towards an object that we're trying to grab a hold of, or associate ourselves with trying to get rid of something that we are already in association with, then that once that has moved a bit further down the energetic road, it becomes clinging. So we get a hold of something, or we identify with something, become something in our hearts, and we hold on to that through clinging. So particularly like patterns of behavior, patterns in relationships that we have with other people, we kind of get used to it. It helps give this kind of sense of stability. We're looking for some sort of sense of stability in our lives, and even if it's a not so healthy kind of relationship, or even if it's a way of being with somebody out of habit, out of conditioning, and it's served its purpose, but we're identified with it, or we're habituated to it enough so that we hold on to it, just because we haven't really realized completely the importance of letting go of this pattern or of these patterns. And it even if it's unskillful or not serving its purpose anymore, it gives us a sense of continuity or a sense of stability. And so it's hard to let go of that. So there's this holding, this clinging, and actually it serves as the basis for all of our suffering. In some form or another, when we suffer, we're clinging to either something in regards to our body or our mind, particularly in our mind. The mind habits, the patterns, the perceptions, the certain kinds of feelings that we hold to and cling to, and then also form an identity around the clinging at its fullest development is when we develop a sense of me or mine, myself, I, around any of these qualities of body and mind. And that lays the basis for dukkha, for suffering. So this is an unskillful form of holding. When it's time to let go, we have difficulty doing that. But all kinds of holding aren't necessarily unskillful energetic states. Kind of the counterpart to that is a skillful form of holding that is you can see in the quality of sati or mindfulness. So that we're consciously trying to hold in our consciousness a skillful set of qualities or a way of viewing our experience. Take whether it's a particular object that we're holding on to and remembering to reflect on that helps lead to calm states of mind in meditation, or helps us develop a greater sense of clarity and insight regarding the body or the mind or certain qualities, skillful qualities. It takes a sense of holding. We have to hold on to these things, to these qualities of mind that will lead us to more peace and clarity and wisdom. Because it's easy to drift, it's easy to forget, and it's easy to let the other influences, the unskillful tendencies that we have in mind, it's easy to lose our capacity to see those as they arise through lack of mindfulness and let them take over again, so that sati, mindfulness, is actually a firm establishing, a holding of certain skillful qualities in mind, and reminding ourselves to keep coming back to them over and over again. So it's the same energetic pattern, in a way, of holding, but it's holding something skillful, holding a set of qualities in mind that are skillful, rather than clinging to what we think will give us stability and happiness. Anger is a trait or characteristic quality of mind that can be a very energizing, very energetic state of mind, produce a state of mind or energy that results oftentimes in quick, strong action, and almost always has unfortunate consequences when we fulfill acting on, even in our own minds, if we don't act on anger through speech or through physical action. The consequences of unleashing anger in the mind is damaging to us. It hurts, it's painful, and has the potential for outward expression if we're not careful, if we're not restrained. So it's a very strong force, and with the potential of being quite destructive. Similar energy pattern can be used, though, in a skillful way. Say that if we find ourselves in a situation, or maybe even like a relationship that is not good, that's maybe even abusive in some ways, certainly causing harm to ourselves, or some pattern of behavior that we ourselves are just very fed up with, you know, harmful, destructive patterns in our own life, where we maybe harm ourselves. Then if we experience that rising up of, just had enough, I just, you know, just don't want to do this anymore, and the realization arises that we need to take action to change a very difficult pattern, whether it's from someone else, our experience with someone else, or whether it's internally, then sometimes that energy can also rise up in a very determined, strong way that will then steer us in a skillful direction. So very strong energy in times of difficulty. If it's anger, it can be result in unwholesome, unskillful qualities and actions. But if it's seen as an energizing motivation for strong, necessary action to get out of a harmful, difficult situation, then it's used for a positive result. So that same kind of strong, forceful energy, but with different underlying tendencies in operation, can have very different results. Another one that comes to mind is that one, they say anyway, it's a peculiarly Western trait of guilt, where we've done something that we regret, feel remorseful about, and pick it up and hold on to it and chew on it and exaggerate it and turn it against ourselves in a very personal way, relive it over and over again, kind of self-blaming, self-castigation. It can be very painful, very difficult to bear that kind of self-recrimination over and over again. And over a period of time, becomes pretty unproductive, but hard to let go of. Very strong conditioning for many of us. Yet it also has its skillful companion, if you will, of a healthy sense of shame or remorse, concern for not wanting to be harmful. The hiri and otapa are the qualities that lead to a skillful kind of circumspection, such that when we've done something that's been unskillful or harmful, if we have this quality of hiri and otapa, then it arises in us this sense of, oh, that was not good, and I don't want to do that anymore. And then that sense of concern for others that helps prevent us from engaging in those kinds of actions that produce that kind of regret or remorse. And that can be a skillful quality if it isn't then personalized and used as a judge and a jury against ourselves. Once the sense of shame arises or the sense of concern arises, then we make note, we take appropriate action, we file it in our system of knowledge about ourselves, and we try and be alert to preventing that from happening in the future. And we let it pass. We let the incident pass. We don't keep regurgitating, reminding ourselves of how awful we were, because that's just another form of anger and resentment, really. And it's just, unless instead of it being externalized to somebody else, it's just internalized against ourselves. But it's that same kind of aversion to ourselves that's the basis for guilt, rather than the wholesome wariness out of concern for unskillful behavior towards ourselves and others. Same kind of energy, but very different results. Fear is strongly embedded quality in many of us, fear, anxiety, that brings a kind of a sense of heightened attention, if you will, in situations, even if they're just interactional situations, not necessarily physically threatening situations, but things that we think are going to hurt us. We develop this mind state of alertness and defensiveness around that, and can sometimes live a life of being constantly on alert to things that may be harmful to us, and find patterns of defensiveness towards those possibilities. And that's what they are. Their possibilities are usually based on imagination or kind of a sense of confusion, not seeing things clearly. But we can also have that same kind of energetic pattern that's used for skillful means, like a sense of alertness, that sense of being on guard against unwholesome mental states, and even of themselves, so that a sense of alertness and energy and attentiveness to things that will be really harmful, not the paper tigers of, you know, that we often imagine are going to harm us, that oftentimes just never manifest based on our own imaginations, but a true sense of alertness and wanting to be ready to see when unskillful qualities are starting to arise and to prevent that from happening. So it can be a bright, clear, energized state of mind that's used for good qualities to develop. One of the other qualities that came to mind when I was thinking about this was affection, which is oftentimes a very wholesome quality, even in a conditioned kind of way. We certainly need it when we're growing up. If we don't have that kind of affection and contact, at least to some degree, when we're growing up, there's just not much hope for normal development, developing a sense of self-esteem and how to navigate ourselves, navigate our way through the world of other people. Helps give us a sense of self-confidence that we are worthy. So affection from parents or mentors along the way is something that we all need. And we carry that kind of sense of affection, wanting to be with certain other people, liking of certain qualities, sense of caring and warmth, into our relationships in adulthood. And these can be used in very skillful ways as well. Family life, skillful relationships, intimate relationships with others. A sense of affection is very important to serve as a basis. it's a kind of energy that's warm and gentle and caring. And if it's held in maybe too much of an individualized kind of a way, can be the basis for attachment. And if we limit this kind of affection to, say, only to people that we like, or that we feel particularly attracted to, or sensually desirous of, if that's where we keep our affection focused, then this sense of attachment can grow around that quality of affection, so that when situations change, when you know the natural tendencies to grow apart or grow differently from each other, to move apart, cause separation, or when just through the natural process of say aging and death, take away those people whom we've attached to with affection, but kind of on a dependent basis, then we suffer with that loss, because that sense of well-being is dependent on a single person or a few people or particular ways that they treat us that we find pleasing, or particularly qualities that they have that we are attracted to. And when that changes, then we feel the loss and the suffering of the ending of that. So there's, in that kind of affection that's singular or narrowly focused, there's the potential for suffering when it changes. A similar kind of energy, but less personal and more global, is, of course, metta, loving kindness, friendliness, and that sense of a non-specific, more broader-based caring, wishing for the happiness of others, a sense of warmth and well-being that comes and can be very broad-based and non-specific. And you know, that's one of the things, personally, just speaking for myself, that I find really advantageous and useful, say, in the life as a monastic, or for people who have chosen to necessarily not be in a, say, a particular one-on-one relationship. There's a freedom to have and develop more easily that sense of global loving kindness for all people, not just more narrowly focused and free from the usual, rituals or personal rules that we have in a personal singular relationship. Don't have to limit that that sense of openness and attentiveness and caring as much. There's more space, more time, more freedom to develop that sense of caring, compassion, kindness, and true kind of a mature affection for a broad group of people, even developing it for people that we have difficulties with, because we let go of the personal nature of it and just develop it as a quality inside ourselves, for ourselves, and for all living creatures. Same kind of energy, warmth and caring, but without that narrow focus and with less attachment as to wanting to get something back in return, or to have to hold to a certain set of behaviors. (Clears throat) So these are the kind of the examining and getting to know the different kinds of energies that we can experience and manifest, and looking below them to see what's motivating how it's expressed, whether it's one of these underlying more unskillful tendencies that we've been habituated to, or through a more skillful basis of intention, motivation, that draws us into the development and maintaining of the wholesome qualities that describe right effort. And with those as a basis for our practice, we can then really more fully develop that skillful holding of mindfulness and clear comprehension as we develop our meditation practice that then serves as this basis for examining on a very deep level the true cause of suffering, and to see how gradually through the development of these positive energies underlying our actions, that serves as the foundation, the basis for developing deeper levels of insight, calm, that can lead to a skillful form of letting go. We were also talking about, say, disenchantment and dispassion at tea time, and differentiating, that's another one of those kind of qualities that can be based in either skillful energy patterns or unskillful ones. If the underlying motivation is wanting to avoid or wanting to get away from some difficult situation or some unpleasant situation that we're in, that can lead to kind of a withdrawal or indifference towards something. And that's not the kind of disenchantment or moving away from dispassion that the Buddha talks about. But if the underlying motivation is one of just having seen clearly that certain patterns or certain activities are just no longer suitable for us, not through aversion or through wanting to get away from something, but just that whatever it is has served its purpose and it's not something we need to be holding on to anymore, then that can serve as a basis for a real, much more skillful kind of disenchantment, the one just where we see we're not fooled by the enchantment of a certain situation anymore, and we see through it. And then there's just a natural letting go, not one based on indifference or avoidance or aversion, but a natural letting go. And that's the, you know, the energetic quality of mind that is moving in the direction towards liberation. That sense of release, relinquishment, letting go, as an energetic state of mind. It's a letting go of the clinging, letting go of the craving, and through wisdom, through clear seeing, not through any kind of unhealthy avoidance or aversion. So with that sense of true dispassion, true disenchantment, it just becomes natural to relinquish, to let go, and to let the mind move into a state of non-clinging, non-holding, non-becoming, that is the door to true freedom, complete freedom, the deathless, if we let it take us that far. So just a few words on virya, the quality of virya energy, and how to work with that in a skillful way. So I'll leave that for this evening's contemplation. Namayam dhamma kataya sadhu karanta dhamma se sadhu sadhu.